This is Noisy People. I'm Tim Perkis. Today, my guest is saxophonist, composer, and band leader, John Raskin. This is the Rova Saxophone Quartet playing John Raskin's composition, Wig Hag Six Step, in 2004. The San Francisco Bay Area creative music scene is an unusually eclectic place. Musicians form groups easily, combining and recombining in endless variations. From night to night, the same players in different groupings might be playing a noisy electronics gig, 20th century chamber music, art metal rock, or improvisations using Asian folk instruments. This spirit of cooperation and openness is amazing. But the downside of this eclecticism is that often these groupings are short-term, lasting a gig or two, and never achieve the depth that only time can give a band. My guest, John Raskin, is one of these highly recombinant players, with the added difference that he, along with his partners in the Rova Saxophone Quartet, have also been in an active, ever-changing collaboration for over 35 years. This group has through the years refined an approach to composition mixed with improvisation, including developing a language of over 50 hand signal cues that they call radar. I recently talked to John in his Oakland studio, and I started our conversation by asking what he's gained by pursuing such a long-term collaboration.
What do you gain? Well, the ensemble gains a lot. You have so much background and history on terms of making your sound, putting your sounds together, that, you know, you can get at nuances that you just really don't even begin to think about when you just get together with a group short term. We decided very early on that we really wanted to explore compositional practices with improvisers as a focus, that the compositions would blend in with our improvising. We would put these things together with little bits of writing and some improvisation, and then we would move on to the next one, and sometimes we got to version 10. It was kind of the amalgamation of all the best stuff that we had done in these things as a piece. And that practice has continued. You know, You know, we have a radar series where we look at games and sound processes and stuff like that, and we put together and create pieces out of the radar group of things, which centers around hand signals.
You really have this language that you develop using multiple pieces, right? That's the same kind of...
And radar stuff goes back into the pieces that we compose. So somebody composes and they'll figure out a specific kind of radar map to put in the pieces, right? It's a it's a scenario. You know, this happens. And it goes through some kind of scenario. And it just kind of tells you, here are we got 50 plus signals.
The hand signals.
Yeah.
50 plus hand signals.
Yeah. Some cues are sound and process cues. Some cues are just process cues. And so you sit there and you make mixes of, all right, we're going to use these process cues. You cue in a process. Now you keep the process and you change the sounds.
Oh, I see.
Then somebody comes along and says, keep the sounds and change the processes.
So the cues mean the same thing out of this vocabulary. They're consistent across time.
Right.
But you decide in a particular piece that you're going to
focus on this subset for this part. Yeah,
this is how
we're going to, you know, put this piece together, this timeline. So it's building a narrative, right? You can sit there and decide on a kind of narrative and sound world you want to explore. It ends up being a composition generator.
Yeah. You know, I read this book once about it was kind of profile of these different companies that have been around for 100 years or more.
Mm-hmm.
They're basically, the way they survive is they've got something that persists, but they've got some way to have it constantly be adjusting and changing. And it's kind of like you have this process mm-hmm. that is a constant across all these years, it seems like, but it's a very creative process. It's a process that's constantly generating new combinations and new ideas and incorporates new ideas. Yeah.
Yeah. Because initially it was just us improvising group pieces and then individual members brought in compositions. Then at some point we decided, let's commission people to write for us, but keep the idea that it has to be, you know, for improvisers, some blend of improvisation. And then that, you know, we've done that for over 20 years now, commissioned works and brought them in. And that brought in a lot of, you know, new information to the group and different, you know, skill sets that we'd have to master.
Yeah.
And put us in contact with interesting people. And then we do collaborations, which is the other thing that keeps us engaged. So we've collaborated with, you know, a Taiko Dojo group, we've all kinds of dancers, with film, with, you know, other musicians.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah, we bring in people and put in large ensemble pieces.
This is Orchestrova, a project of Rova, doing John Coltrane's Ascension from their 2005 CD, Electric Ascension.
I mean, we got lucky in the late 70s, early 80s, there was still funding in America and in Europe that was extensive. So we got to kind of get out there and actually tour and get established in the larger music scene, which has always been a problem for Bay Area musicians.
Right.
It's really hard to get out of here and make a name for yourself where you can get on a circuit that will pay you decent fees, you know.
Yeah.
We're not a media center like LA is,
right.
You know. So for like foreign work, they go to LA and New York and they'll check out the scenes there and report on them, you know. It would be an adventuresome person that would come up to San Francisco and talk about it.
Yeah. All you guys individually always have like other projects going and, you know, it's always like, so it's not becoming like...
it's not the only thing that we do.
It's not becoming a stifling thing because y'all have other outlets and other things you're doing.
Yeah. You know, the language poets of San Francisco had a big influence on Rova.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Can you talk about how it manifested in the music? Or?
Well, I got introduced to the language poets through, you know, Larry's wife, Lynn, you know, and I would go to the readings and get the books and kind of read it. And then, you know, first of all, it's kind of you know, a little bit impenetrable, right?
Yeah.
And then I realized that especially Lynn and Ginny and Carla Harriman's work, you know, the way they dealt with time was really, really interesting, right? And that words didn't necessarily have to have this narrative sequential meaning. you could change the sense of time and place and context and
basically musical concerns in the
all of a sudden you're saying, you know, this really has a lot to do with what we're trying to do in improvisation, you know. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to have a narrative that, you know, starts at the beginning and ends at the end, you know.
This is Fish Speech from John's collaboration with poet Carla Harriman from their 2012 CD, Open Box.
Wanted to talk to you a little bit about graphic scores in general and your kind of what you think about how you think about graphic scores.
Oh, okay.
I always find them troublesome and difficult to know like what to do with them.
What are you asking me to do?
What are you asking me to do? How does this relate to what I'm playing? Am I supposed to like follow this line around this way? And does that mean I go high or low? Or, you know, it always seems like it's, I just never quite know what the fuck, you know, how literal or how inspirational in some broader sense it's meant to be. And I find your scores that I've seen are really beautiful, and they seem to be operating on this level of, I think of that Indian concept, it's in Javanese music as well, of rasa. As an artist, you need to take in beauty.
Right.
And that it kind of tumbles around and comes out.
Yeah.
And you're playing. And so that you're looking at this thing that has this kind of formal structure to it and a beauty to it, and that that's that it works in that level. But
Well, that was actually part of the intent. I mean, I got to this point where I looked at the music that I was writing, and I looked at it and go, most of the ideas are not on the page, right? Uh-huh. Basically, what I'm handing people is some written music for some notes I want you to play, and a little bit of a map. But there's nothing on there that actually has any of the intent of the music, right? I've always been a big fan of Kandinsky, and, you know, and he was into improvisation, and he was into music, and he was into lots of different art forms, and you know, like bringing them into his world. And I'd done graphic scores before, people had presented to me, and I had a lot of the responses you had to the graphic scores. What do you want me to do here? You know, here's a squiggly line. Okay, I'll play a squiggly line, you know. And, but one of the things that struck me about looking at art is that you consider visual information, right? Mm-hmm. You look at it and you find correspondences and you think about things and you have this kind of engagement with your mind as you're looking at visual art. And I thought, well, I think that's what I want to do is try to get that engagement as an active engagement. You could almost say that all composed work, right, is a graphic score, right?
You mean all notated work?
All notated work. And you put it on a piece of paper. It's basically a graphic score, a representation of what you're supposed to do. And since I'm interested in improvisation, I'm going, I don't really need all these subtle details telling you exactly what to do.
Right.
But I still want this engagement of looking at it and letting you draw ideas from it and then playing.
Right. And sort of like escape from just pure improvisation is sort of like maybe too internal in a way or something. And so yeah. so that the player is actually responding to something and right. something exterior without too much over direction.
Right. And it would be I guess what I would say, a lot of these scores have, you know, an instruction where you engage in the graphic, right? And then when you get a sound area, you just, go with it, right? You go back to your ears. You don't have to keep looking at the page, right? You're playing. And then when that idea goes, the instruction is to go back to the graphic, stop the idea rather than just being sequential ideas from the soundscape, right? And then go back to the score and then use that as the generative place to come up with the next musical thing that you do.
Well, I see. So you're not really, they don't read like top to bottom, left to right.
Generally they don't. You know.
Or do they specify a path at all?
There could be some paths, or there could be relationships, or you know. It's interesting because Xenakis did a lot of graphic work, and then he did realizations from his graphic works into notated scores that he handed to the musicians because he really didn't want the musicians to have composer credit. Maybe that's not the way that
it's kind of a social thing about,
it's my responsibility to give the musicians something they should play and I'm giving them, but he conceived them in this completely other graphical imagination.
Yeah.
I read that and I go, I'm not so concerned about composition credit or I actually like the idea of the musician. I mean, the thing about being an improviser is you've decided that you're going to develop your language. Right.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking at your instrument and you're trying to find these correspondence with your instrument that really somehow are the essence of you as a musician.
Just generally in the career of an improviser.
You've made this decision you're ready to deal with somebody else's language. And the assumption is that person's ready to deal with your language.
Right.
Right. It's a democratic process or something
right.
like that.
It's a different power relationship.
It's a different power relationship. You're saying, I'm going to say what I need to say, but I'm going to listen to what you've got to say, and we're going to try to make this work, right? And right. I want to honor that. In the graphic scores, I was just honoring that as I'm giving you parameters, but you're still an improviser, right?
Yeah.
You know?
I always think of that as the master composers in jazz or whatever are all people who have enough respect for the creativity of the musicians that they don't hold them too tightly and
I view that as kind of I would put that out more as the African aesthetic in American music as opposed to just jazz, which is kind of a limiting
right.
kind of
right.
just this it's not it's really an African aesthetic aesthetics. The melting pot of American art is that all the cultural groups that have come to America bring their aesthetics in, and they cross influence.
Mm-hmm. In general, do you kind of create these different groups that you've created as a band leader as a kind of platform to look at these graphic score kind of ways of organizing things, or is that just one of the ways you organize?
I had a 10-year period where that's all I did was graphic. When I wrote music, it was graphic scores mm-hmm. predominantly. Mm-hmm. And I went and did it I did it in Rova. We did graphic scores in Rova. And then I put groups together because I want to play with the musicians.
Yeah.
This is Cube. Q-U-P-E by John Raskin, played by the John Raskin Quartet. Liz Albee, trumpet, George Cromashie, bass, Gino Robert, percussion, along with John on saxophones, from their eponymous 2012 CD on Rastascan. The graphic score for this piece can be seen in the show notes at noisypeople.net. Thank you.
I wanted to talk a little bit about this other interest that you've shown about Jews harps, or is that what they're called? Is that the right thing to call them?
It's a common name for them in America.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with Jews. You know, it could be a bastardization of a French word for
a jaw or...
I'm not quite sure. I forget what that was. But in many cultures, it's just a mouth harp or...
Mouth harp,
or
yeah.
A jaw harp or...
Yeah.
But, you know...
So you somehow got on this. I think I've seen you've done these very interesting performances where they have collected them, right, from different cultures and...
Well, a friend of mine was traveling in Southeast Asia and brought me back a bamboo jaw harp that, and they're very prevalent in Southeast Asian culture, brass ones and bamboo ones. And, you know, I threw it in my case, and I loved it as an instrument because it's like really quiet. You know, if you just want to pick out an instrument and play without disturbing people, it was the perfect thing to do, you know. At some point, I just said, you know, it's strange. I actually have a lot of recordings of these instruments. None of that. It's just a record, a recording of just that. But if you have any kind of ethnic music collection, you've got tracks from all over the world of these things. And it just kind of, then I thought, well, that's pretty interesting. It's like they're really spread out all over the world, these instruments. You know, it's a folk instrument. And
is there a sense that it was invented and propagated, or kind of multiply invented, or invented once and,
you know,
propagated around the world?
You can see where steel-framed ones populated from Europe and went around the world.
This is a live recording from a 2014 performance in Berkeley of John Raskin and percussionist John Haynes, performed on two jaw harps.
So then I started getting more serious about actually playing them and learning the techniques. And everywhere I traveled, I'd go around and try to find a local version of it. Was just a fun thing to do. You go to a country and say, okay, who are the hand makers in this country, and try to get some.
Yeah.
And they're cheap, cool. You know.
It's like, yeah, right. So they're kind of the rhythm section for a lot of like sort of vocal music or
farmers' kind of music, shaman music.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Because it does have this strange, it does have this kind of otherworldly, trancy kind of thing
about it. Yeah, I think, you know, it's still the shaman music in Siberia. Mm-hmm. You know, those countries, the shamans would play them. And...
All right. Thanks, John.
You're welcome.
This has been the Noisy People Podcast, episode number 7. The podcast is available through iTunes subscription and on the website at noisypeople.net, where you can also find images and additional information about the artists and their music. This show is also available through our partner, creativedisturbance.org, an initiative of Leonardo, the MIT Press, and the University of Texas in Dallas. This is episode number 7 and was produced in May of 2015.